Good evening. My name is David McKnight, and I would like to welcome you to Penn's Rare Book and Manuscript Library and the second installment of this year's Rosenbach Lectures, which are being delivered by the distinguished historian Elizabeth L. Eisenstein. Before giving the podium over to our speaker, I would like to take a moment to explain that I'd hoped to use this occasion of the Rosenbach Lectures to present the top three prizes in Penn Library's inaugural student book collecting competition sponsored by the J. Kislick Family Foundation. Some of you may have seen the poster that was hanging in the library both on the sixth floor and at the entrance over the past 5 months. But like the much discussed and recently passed healthcare reform bill, the judges are still in deliberation and I hope to have the results shortly. Possibly Thursday, but at any rate, the judges are hard at work deliberating. From the first moment that the Kislack Foundation agreed to fund the competition, I was thrilled. The basic concept is that full-time students at Penn, undergraduate or graduate, who were under 30 years of age, were invited to submit a short essay and a representative list of their collection. It seemed fitting that the prize be awarded at the same time as we're honoring A.S.W. Rosenbach. The competition was launched in October and the deadline was February 28th. The first prize winning entry will be submitted to the National Book Collecting Contest, which has been which will be managed, I think for the foreseeable future, by the Library of Congress with the generous support of the Kislack Family Foundation funding. Jay Kislack is among the most distinguished book collectors of the past 50 years. After several months of fretting whether I would receive any submissions, and others were under the gun too, particularly as we speculate about the fate of the physical book, the rise of multitasking, laptops, Kindles, smartphones, portable DVD players, database culture, and the ubiquitous World Wide Web, where are the young book collectors, I have wondered, as well as booksellers and others, I'm sure. Look to the university, I thought. Sure enough, there are, I'm happy to report, young collectors who are knowledgeable and savvy. Despite not having the results, Elizabeth Kislack has agreed to come this evening to this evening's lecture and say a few words on behalf of the family, the Kislack Family Foundation. So I invite Libby Kislack to come up and say a few words, and thank you for indulging me.
Greetings from my grandpa and from the rest of the Family Foundation. My grandfather believes that books are important, and his collection numbers more than 10,000. It has taken him a lifetime to collect it. The stories I've been reading about my fellow Penn students and their collections are really amazing. They have such wonderful and interesting items. In reading through their submissions, what struck me most was how these young collectors valued their books, not only for what was written inside, but also for the memories the physical object brings out. They shared personal anecdotes about their acquisitions or where and when they first read their favorite pieces. One can read for facts, one can read for amusement, or one can read because one has to. But for those who keep their books, it's usually about much more than that. In an age where the internet has put so much digital information at our fingertips, our family is proud to sponsor this competition, to honor young collectors, and to celebrate the idea of books as much as the ideas within them. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Libby. Libby has to now rush off and write a final exam. So thank you for sparing your time this evening. And stay tuned for the results. We'll post them on the library website as soon as I have them. This evening, Betty Eisenstein will deliver the second of her three Rosenbach lectures. Last evening, Betty's lecture entitled First Impressions set the stage for the general title of her lectures and theme, Divine Art, Infernal Machine. Eisenstein was educated at Vassar College, where she received her BA, then went on to Radcliffe College for her MA and PhD. It was there that she studied under Crane Brinton. She taught at the American University from 1959 to 1974, then the University of Michigan, where she was the Alice Freeman Palmer Professor of History. In 1979, she was resident consultant for the Center for the Book at the Library of Congress. She has held positions as a fellow at the Humanities Research Center of the Australian National University and at the Center for Advanced Study in the Behavioral Sciences, Palo Alto. Eisenstein was visiting professor at Wolfson College, Oxford, and published her lectures from that period as Grub Street Abroad. She is currently professor emerita at the University of Michigan. Eisenstein's best-known work is The Printing Press as an Agent of Change, a two-volume, 750-page exploration of the effects of movable printing, of movable type printing, on the literate elite of post-Gutenberg Western Europe. In this work, she focuses on the printing press's functions of dissemination, standardization, and preservation, and the way these functions aided the progress of the Protestant Reformation, the Renaissance, and the Scientific Revolution. Eisenstein's work brought historical method, rigor, and clarity to earlier ideas of Marshall McLuhan, who has always been thought of as sort of a fuzzy thinker, and others about the general social effects of such media transitions. This work provoked debate in the academic community from the moment it was published, and is still inspiring conversation and new research today. Her work also influenced later thinking about the subsequent development of digital media. Her work on the transition from manuscript to print influenced thought about new transitions of print text to digital formats, including multimedia and new ideas about the definition of the text. Eisenstein has received various awards and recognitions, including fellowships from the John Simon Guggenheim Memorial Foundation, the National Endowment for the Humanities, and the Rockefeller Foundation. In 2002, she received the American Historical Association's Award for Scholarly Distinction. And in 2004, the University of Michigan awarded her the honorary degree of Doctor of Humane Letters. In 1993, the National Coalition of Independent Scholars created the Eisenstein Prize, which is awarded biannually to members of the organization who have produced work with an independent focus. This evening, Betty will deliver her second lecture entitled 18th Century Attitudes. Please welcome Elizabeth Eisenstein.
I wonder if you can hear me all right, way back there. Everything all right? Good. I'm sensitive because I'm hard of hearing myself, and when I sit in back, I really can't hear very well. I was going to start this lecture displaying an 18th century image of printing as a heaven-sent invention. But then I realized that yesterday I'd started with a 15th century tribute to printing as a divine art. I didn't want to overdo the single triumphal theme, so I'm going to begin instead with a split screen to indicate negative as well as positive reactions. And this is also, I must say, suggestive of the book jacket of my forthcoming book. Above is the spirit of printing in the heavens. I really don't need to point it out, but this doesn't work.
Turn it around the other way, other direction.
Just there,
yeah, there we go.
There.
You can tell I'm not very good at printing. This is the spirit of printing, and if I had a good close-up, you would see there are vowels. The five vowels decorations are around, and all sorts of interesting things going on. But she's holding a wooden hand press, which I feel is a little earthbound to be up in the heavens. But never mind, that's where it is. It's being escorted down from the heavens, and I will come in a while to what's going on. Below is a London printing shop, inhabited by beasts and monsters. I don't need to point that out to you. Both images appeared within the same decade, between 1732 and 1740. One is taken from a French text, the other from an English journal. Incidentally, these two images inspired my title, Divine Art, Infernal Machine. The top image is a frontispiece of a commemorative volume on the history and early progress of printing, written in French and published in Amsterdam in 1740. And I must say, when I first saw this, which was about 25 years ago at the Library of Congress in the Grand Folio volume, it blew my mind. And it's still, to me, a fascinating engraving because so much is packed into it. And I'm not going to try to unpack it all here. That would be impossible. But in any case, you have this remarkable engraving, and we have the original for it. I'm not going to show that to you, knowing that it was to help you understand that it was planned by the author of the text. It's the frontispiece of a commemorative volume on the history and early progress of printing, written in French, and published in Amsterdam in 1740. It was composed by Prosper Marchand, who had been a privileged printer in Paris before converting to Protestantism and leaving France for the Netherlands in 1709. Yesterday, I mentioned the major censorship decree of 1515 of the Roman Church that had described printing as an invention that came down from the heavens as a gift of God. Marchand's text makes no mention of the papal sponsorship of early printing. He tells us instead that after the Protestants had praised printing as a gift of heaven, the monks attacked it and condemned it as an infernal art. His frontispiece shows the wooden hand press held by the spirit of printing being escorted in her descent by Mercury, messenger of the gods. I'll get there. There he is. And by Minerva, the patron of early printing, of 16th century printing workers. They used to parade statues of Minerva in the streets, the goddess of wisdom, of course, and the patron of many different libertine enclaves in the 18th century, and also, of course, the patron of numerous Athenaeums to this day. When we turn away from the heavens to the grouping on the ground, we can see that the three Protestant powers, there's one, there's two, and there's three, those are the three Protestant powers, are set against the two Catholic powers. This is Germany, who has pride of place, as I noted yesterday. The Germans claim pride of place from the very beginning, and they're holding medallions showing Gutenberg and his partner, the financier Fust, and there's a medallion somewhere that's empty that I cannot locate from this distance, of the son-in-law, the man who married the boss's daughter, Peter Scheffer, but there was no portrait to put on it, so it's sort of invisible. It's right there. Anyway, there's Germany holding Gutenberg and Fust. Then next comes Holland holding Coster. And I don't know if any of you are Dutch, but I have talked to audiences where there's somebody who's Dutch there, and they say that school children still learn Coster invented printing rather than Gutenberg. And that argument has gone on from the beginning, and it continues, I think. I don't know whether it continues till this day, but it was continuing about 30 years ago. Anyway, the Dutch were very annoyed by the fact that Coster comes below Gutenberg, and Prosper Marchand was living in Holland and lived there for 40 years, and they were annoyed at him for various reasons. Among others, he never learned to speak Dutch, and this was true of the French enclave within which he moved. None of them learned to speak Dutch. And yet they lived in Holland. They couldn't even ask directions as to get from one place to another because they refused to speak Dutch. And then finally, you may recognize this portrait. It's William Caxton. This is the personification of England holding Caxton. And I think I've already pointed out that printing had come to Italy and France before Caxton set up shop in England, but, as I noted, the first Italian and the first French presses were set up by Germans. So the portraits on the medallions held by Italy and by France represent native sons who were relative latecomers and were especially admired by Prosper Marchand. Italy, which is represented by the triple tiara of the Roman, well, you can't miss that, of the Roman Pope, the triple tiara, is holding not a Roman printer, but a Venetian printer, Aldus Manutius. He prospered between 1490 and 1510, when the independent republic on the Adriatic was at odds with the Pope, and Venetian presses were turning out anti-clerical materials. France holds Robert Etienne, the member of the most famous of all 16th century French printing dynasties. Robert Etienne, who died in 1550, represented not the first, but the third generation of the Etiennes to work in the family's business. Although he was far from the first son to ply his trade, he was the first member of his family to leave his native land and take his trade to foreign soil. After his Latin editions of the Bible were condemned by the Sorbonne, Robert left France for Geneva, where he spent his last 8 years. His being singled out in the engraving as the paradigmatic printer of Catholic France had a paradoxical aspect. This distinction was conferred on one who had set up business in a foreign Protestant land. It's worth mentioning that there is no personification of Geneva to set beside that of France, just as there's none of Venice to be juxtaposed with Italy. Marchand's presentation of the history of printing conforms to a pattern which started perhaps with the German glorification of Gutenberg in the late 15th century, to which I alluded yesterday. It prevails even now by being structured along national lines. Indeed, the tendency to use the nation-state as a main frame seems to become ever more pronounced. In addition to the continuous output of histories of German printing, Italian printing, Spanish printing, and so forth, a new series of multi-volume projects are underway. The magnificent four-volume French Histoire de l'édition française. I'm glad that Roger Chartier is here, since he is one of the co-editors of that magnificent four-volume edition. It is now followed by even more massive collaborative works devoted to diverse national histories. The five-volume History of the Book in America has just been completed and will be commemorated at the Library of Congress April 9th. No doubt these works will prove immensely useful, but the way they are framed tends to conceal the political underpinning supplied by Venice, Geneva, and numerous other quasi-autonomous petty principalities and city-states in early modern Europe. To return to Marchand's depiction of printing descending from the heavens, there's only the unstated discrepancy between the figure of France and the medallion of the émigré printer she holds that hints at the existence of two distinctively different 18th century Francophone literary cultures. One Catholic and royal, the other heterodox, and without any special political persuasion. The image of beasts and monsters in the printing shop is obviously anti-commemorative and distinctively English. It was displayed in two successive issues of a satiric London weekly issued by the Scriblerians, a group of disaffected literati who included Swift and Pope. They resented the Hanoverians, the Whig ascendancy, and local booksellers most of all, I think. The caricature depicts a London printing shop where workers with the heads of beasts labor under the direction of a two-faced master printer. Let me see if we can see him here. Working under the direction of a two-faced master printer and a bookseller wearing a monstrous mask. I don't have to do much with that. You can see that, and I'd like you to remember it because I'm not going to show it. I'm going to allude to it again, but this is the only time I'm showing this particular slide. The accompanying text mocks commemorative histories. Instead of master printers in heroic guise, it describes how grimy boys came to be called printers' devils. Quote, Printers use devils as booksellers use authors. All the world agrees their god is mammon. The satiric text encompasses divisions of labor within the printing office. The conventional history of the trades is satirized in the course of settling scores with personal enemies. The dog, the horse, and the swine are assigned multiple roles as printing workers and rival authors. Janus, the two-faced figure who supervises the work, is also assigned different roles. In the guise of a bookseller, he responds to the customer who asks how a book is selling, extremely well. But to the author who asks the same question, he replies very indifferently. In the guise of a printer, Janus issues books which are godly and books which are lewd. As a mercenary author, the same figure defends both virtue and immorality and places his pen at the disposal of Whigs and Tories alike. When presented in juxtaposition, the two images of a heaven-sent invention and beasts in a printing house convey a sense of ambivalence that is often attributed to Western attitudes in general. As suggested by Kurt Bueller's comment, printing was regarded as a blessing and curse, sometimes as both at once. Bueller was Rosenbach lecturer in 1947 and 1959, incidentally. The phrase blessing and curse was applied to printing by a 15th century scholar. Ambivalence is evident in myths about the earliest printers, Gutenberg, inventive genius, his financier Fust, evil sorcerer, or greedy malefactor who robbed the poor inventor of his brainchild. Attitudes toward printing reflected a persistent tension between serving the muses on the one hand and marketing commodities for profit on the other. Perhaps attitudes toward printing, publishing as well as printing, still reflect this persistent tension. Nevertheless, to stop short with the polarities, blessing, curse, God, mammon, is to neglect all that lies in between. Such dichotomies do not do justice to the complexity of both negative and positive reactions. The dramatic contrast provided by the two images, however suggestive and however good for book jackets, is misleading. The Marchand engraving and the Grub Street print represent two extreme poles. The fluctuations that took place in between are not so easily pictured, but need attention nevertheless. On both sides of the channel, reactions were more mixed and more nuanced than any two images or literary fictions might suggest. This is the front page of Marchand's History and Progress, well, Histoire de l'Origine, History of the Origin and Progress of Early Printing. And as you can see, it's an image of Minerva supervising a foundry in a printing shop. It's even more idealized than its frontispiece. Playful putti are doing the work actually done by burly typographers or workmen. I don't think I need to point that out. You can see the putti working in the printing shop. The picture was not only distant from real printing shops, it was also at odds with Marchand's own reactions to the printers of his day. Soon after leaving France for the Netherlands, he found the cutthroat competition in Holland so dismaying, his executor tells us, that he gave up printing and publishing altogether. As an author, he complained about the lazy, incompetent workers. Instead of putti, he had lazy, incompetent workers who had failed to get his book ready in time for the anniversary celebration of printing that was held at the Frankfurt Fair of 1740. In view of his exasperation with contemporary printers, it's worth noting that his book paid tribute to those much earlier Renaissance masters who are portrayed on the medallions. The glorification of these celebrated early masters was a significant feature of 18th century discourse. Addison poked fun at the topos when describing Tom Folio, who esteemed Aldus and the Elseviers more than Virgil and Horace. But the article on printers in L'Encyclopédie by Diderot's chief collaborator, Jaucourt, found nothing funny about the achievements of Gutenberg's early successors. As Roger Chartier has pointed out, Jaucourt's article is full of nostalgic references to a lost golden age. Biographical sketches describe early printers who were martyred for their faith or who managed to produce perfect, error-free editions. This incredible feat is attributed to Marchand's special hero, Robert Etienne, the one who left Paris for Geneva after running into trouble. Etienne is said by Jaucourt, who is also a Protestant, to have achieved perfect error-free editions by the ingenious device of posting proofs on college walls and offering to reward any student who discovered any error. Not only is this unlikely, but far from truth, since Etienne's editions were later found to contain hundreds of errors. Another of Jaucourt's biographical sketches describes a printer who spent millions on his editions, but died poor. It ends with a comment, "Once printing was glorious, now it's nothing but a mercenary craft." Of course, printing had always been a mercenary craft, and there were no error-free perfect editions. As is so often the case, the best of the past was exaggerated to show off, by contrast, the worst of the present. That an iron age of bookselling had superseded a golden age of scholar printers was a common theme among literati on both sides of the channel. It was heavily favored by the scriblarians who blamed English booksellers for overloading markets with worthless stuff. The Grub Street caricature has been reproduced many times to illustrate the disgust of Alexander Pope at the ascendancy of booksellers, and especially to show his hostility provoked by one bookseller who is known to posterity as the unspeakable Curl. Edmund Curl, who was Alexander Pope's bête noir, is represented in the caricature as a bête noir being made to wear this monstrous mask. Just as Marchand's views are misinterpreted if we stop short with the press as a heavenly invention, so too Pope's views are likely to be misconstrued if we stop short with the Grub Street Journal caricature. His well-publicized disdain for booksellers in general, and Curl in particular, did not carry with it a generalized antipathy to the press. "There were two popes," writes Breen Hammond, "the pope who loved print and the pope who hated it. The anti-print pope loathed scandal sheets, pamphlets, scholarly editions, boring poems, most plays, critics, and booksellers. The other pope was fixated on print. He loved its looks. He played with all its devices. He ran his own press, and he promoted his own editions and poems. This other pope was described almost a century ago, quote, 'If Pope is not the greatest among English poets,' wrote R.H. Griffith, 'he is the greatest advertiser and publisher among them.'" Other specialists in Pope studies agree. Nevertheless, the anti-print Pope continues to dominate general treatments of the 18th century literary scene. The apocalyptic finales of the Dunciad are often cited to support this thesis. "Pope has not yet received his due," wrote Marshall McLuhan, "for having discovered the cause of the intellectual malaise of Europe. The poet understood that print had conferred upon dunces an unlimited power to shape and befog the human intellect." Alvin Kernan, who cites McLuhan with approval, similarly takes the Dunciad not as a mock epic, but as a truly prophetic one. "Having fallen into the hands of mercenary entrepreneurs such as Curl," Kernan argues, "print had become a dullish, mechanical, undiscriminating, repetitive mass medium." The Dunciad depicted the flood of printer's ink as a darkness that spread across the land, staining the white page, darkening the minds of people and their rulers, obliterating polite letters, and finally extinguishing all light to leave the land in ancient night and ignorance. The apocalyptic finale of Dunciad's Book 4 pointed to the death of literature, which became the title of Kernan's own subsequent book. Against the notion that a flood of printer's ink pointed to the onset of universal darkness, there's another, to my mind, more plausible interpretation of the finale of the Dunciad. An article by Catherine Ingracia and Claudia Thomas singles out the phrase, "the curtains fall." It notes that the fall of a curtain leaves spectators in the dark, but only temporarily. It signifies the end of one performance, not the end of the world. Indeed, Pope had designed the Dunciad to be the opening salvo in a prolonged battle of books. Shortly before publication, an advertisement was circulated. "Speedily will be published The Progress of Dullness, an historical poem by an eminent hand. The price is one shilling sixpence. Having stirred up angry authors and profiteering booksellers, Pope managed to make publication day a veritable media event. The term media event has recently been applied quite appropriately to the publication of Pamela in 1740. As Thomas Kiemer and Peter Saber demonstrate, Richardson's multiple roles as author, printer, and co-publisher enabled him to manipulate the novel's reception in such a way as to prolong its popularity and extend its readership. Kiemer and Saber also point out that the Scriblerians similarly profited, both from the earlier texts they attacked and the later ones they provoked. Thus, Pope's original publication in 1728 initiated a prolonged cycle. When the opponents of the Dunciad struck back, they did so by generating enough printed materials to fill four albums, which were exploited by Pope when preparing his Variorum edition. In the case of Pamela, the initial event was skillfully designed to maintain the illusion that an actual correspondence was being placed before the reader. Richardson posed as editor, not author, of the epistolatory interchange. He invited his actual readers to become contributors by inserting blank pages in the printed text. When real letters were sent in, they were published in subsequent editions. The translations, the sequels, the parodies that ensued encouraged more interactive reader response and further suspension of disbelief. Plays were written and staged, one by Voltaire, two by Goldoni. Poems appeared in newspapers, paintings, engravings, and wax figures were produced. Racehorses were named. The proliferating publicity redounded to the benefit of the author, printer. Richardson's artful self-effacement, together with his capacity to elicit real tears from real readers, led to his glorification as the divine Richardson. As Roger Chartier has noted, his death elicited a eulogy from Diderot, who had never met him, but who gasped and sobbed when reading his novel. The selling of Pamela and the sanctification of its author set the pattern for subsequent reactions to characters and novels by authors such as Rousseau and Goethe and their 19th century successors. The fan mail that was generated, together with all the other commemorative objects, suggests that the Iron Age of the bookseller represented the dawn of a new golden age for the author as celebrity. As noted below, such media events had political as well as literary repercussions. Witness the remarkable resonance of the actions of John Wilkes. Benjamin Franklin, who brought out an edition of Pamela in 1742, would eventually be accorded an apotheosis that was akin to that received by the divine Richardson. The pessimistic outlook of a Scriblerian seems to be especially compatible with our own postmodern temper, or at least with McLuhan's and Kernan's postmodern temper. But it was less compatible with prevailing literary currents in Georgian England. Addison, who introduced the term Republic of Letters to English readers, described printing as this great invention of these latter days, an invention that enabled books to achieve immortality. Had the philosophers and great men of antiquity, he wrote, been possessed of the art, there's no question but that they would have taken advantage of it to diffuse good sense through the bulk of a people. The early success of The Spectator led Addison to reflect in a self-congratulatory vein on his success in achieving this goal. It was said of Socrates that he brought philosophy down from the heavens to inhabit among men, and I shall be ambitious to have it said of me that I brought philosophy out of closets and libraries and schools and colleges to dwell in clubs and assemblies, at tea tables and in coffee houses. In keeping with this celebrated pronouncement, John Gay asserted that Addison and Steele had rescued learning out of the hands of pedants and fools and had discovered the true way of making it lovely to all mankind. Recent studies have pointed out that for Addison and Steele, all mankind actually consisted of a restricted male elite. Those who gathered at tea tables and coffee houses remained at a considerable distance from the inhabitants of Gin Lane. The Spectator preached the virtues of moderation and politeness in the hopes of restraining the unbridled enthusiasm that had accompanied civil war. It reflected a preference for oligarchy over democracy. Nevertheless, copies of the journal found their way into a wider public domain and were read with profit by autodidacts, such as Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin keeps cropping up in my talk, and that's very appropriate, I think, given Peter Stolybras's interest in him. Well, everybody in Philadelphia is interested in him. As the late Roy Porter has recently documented, the 18th century was above all an age of improvement. Wherever ideas of progress were set forth, the advantages of printing over hand copying were likely to be extolled. L'Encyclopédie was no exception. To be sure, there was the one article that I cited earlier that expressed nostalgia for a golden age of master printers. But it was outnumbered by numerous other articles that expressed pleased amazement at the recent advancement of learning and letters. Think of the progress that's been made in the sciences and the arts, wrote D'Alembert in his preliminary discourse. Think of the many truths that were unveiled today which were not dreamed of before. This pleased amazement was coupled with an appreciation of the useless Latin learning of Renaissance scholars and belittling comments about previous works of reference. Failure of previous compilations to incorporate remarkable advances in such fields as mathematics and physics showed the need for a new encyclopedia, an updated reference work upon which posterity could build. No doubt this repudiation of outdated reference works was self-serving to impress prospective subscribers for the desirability of a new encyclopedia. The obsolescence of previous ones needed to be made clear. It would be odd indeed to find a publisher or editor informing potential purchasers that their new reference work was inferior to previous ones. Nevertheless, D'Alembert was also expressing personal convictions. As a mathematician himself, he was fully aware of the remarkable achievements of mathematical wizards such as Descartes and Pascal and Leibniz and Newton. Diderot was also alert to advances in the mathematical sciences, but he was especially intent on improvements in the mechanical arts. He belittled previous encyclopedias for relying too much on other books and not enough on investigating improvements in working routines. On this point, he cited Francis Bacon, a philosopher whom I never tire praising because I can never tire of reading him, he wrote. Diderot's enthusiasm for artisanal labor was accompanied by a devaluation of the liberal arts, I'm sorry to say. The liberal arts have sung their own praises long enough. They should now raise their voice and praise the mechanical arts and free them from the degradation in which they have so long been held by prejudice. Of course, there was one mechanical art that was especially well suited to singing its own praise, as Diderot, who spent his life among booksellers, was well aware. Unlike many other men of letters, he even had a good word for bookselling, which he called the most noble of all commercial professions. I might note that a syndicate of booksellers had rescued him from the prison of Vincennes at that point. Later on, he had other feelings about booksellers. But he singled out the printing crafts for special treatment. L'Encyclopédie famously devoted many articles and illustrations to typography, with the technical section being written by the foreman of the printing shop. I'm sure you're familiar with these plates from L'Encyclopédie. They've certainly been recycled a great deal. And this is one that shows you also a little close-up detail of type itself. And then this is the interior of a printing shop, which has led Robert Darnton, a recent Rosenbach lecturer, to contrast the immaculate interiors filled with figures resembling wind-up dolls with real printing shops, which contain urine-soaked printing balls, real men waiting about in filthy papers, swilling wine, banging their composing sticks, bellowing and brawling. Of course, I do think that picture is a bit overdone. You wonder how they ever got out any books if that was the situation. In any case, smells and dirt and noise are not easily conveyed by print, which lent itself to the silent, colorless, odorless universe of the new physics. Moreover, the plates were designed not as contributions to labor history, but to implement the Baconian mission of disclosing craft secrets. The texts and plates of L'Encyclopédie show how the praise of printing continued to emanate from printing shops, much as had been the case 300 years earlier. If you remember, in my last lecture, I talked about printing being the first craft that could advertise itself, and the early printers being among the first to talk about how wonderful this new craft was. 18th century tributes to printing also emanated from other venues. The preservative powers of print had been prominent in 18th century discourse about arts and letters, but other aspects of Gutenberg's invention came to the fore when writers addressed the political scene. The increasingly widespread use of print, it was argued, had outmoded Montesquieu's theories about limiting democracy to small political units. In 18th century England, journalists such as Junius claimed to represent the views of disenfranchised readers who represented the nation out of doors. Such journalists were denounced as forlorn grubs and gazetteers who proclaim themselves free-born Englishmen and insist on having a spoke in the wheel of government. Whether welcomed or deplored, there was general agreement that the conduct of political affairs had become much more difficult to contain within traditional structures. This was made clear by the eventual outcome of the Wilkes Affair from 1762 to 1774. As the self-appointed protagonist of an exciting narrative involving defiance of the king, repeated arrests and imprisonment, repeated expulsions by Parliament, mob uprisings, and finally electoral triumphs that culminated in regaining a seat in Parliament, an election as Lord Mayor of London, and a new dance called the Wilkes Wriggle, John Wilkes won a special niche in British political history. He also left his mark on place names in the American colonies, most notably in Pennsylvania, where the city of Wilkes-Barre still couples his name with that of General Isaac Barre, who, like Wilkes, defended the American cause in Parliament. Wilkes showed how press campaigns, when combined with trials by jury, could energize urban crowds and enable even disenfranchised subjects to carry the day. Bourbon France lacked a lively newspaper press, jury trials, and representative assemblies. No meetings of an Estates General had been held for more than a century. Yet even under an absolutist regime, royal ministers could not entirely disregard publications that commanded a following among members of the French reading public. As one contemporary observer pointed out, the term public opinion was acquiring a new meaning. In ancient and medieval times, it had been associated with official surveillance, when the authorities sought to determine whether the ruler was being praised or maligned. They were, in a sense, gauging public opinion. The new meaning had little to do with the traditional monitoring of gossip and rumors by the police. It meant going over the heads of duly constituted authorities and appealing to the good sense of the reading public at large. Or as the Americans put it, it meant having a decent respect for the opinion of mankind. In 1775, Malesherbes, the director of the French book trade, gave an audience upon being admitted to the French Academy that described this enlightened century as a century where each citizen can speak to the entire nation by means of the printing press. In this century, he went on, men of letters are in the midst of a dispersed public, what the orators of Rome and Athens had been in the midst of a people assembled. The expansion of the political arena beyond gatherings that could stand within earshot of a speaker entailed less dependence on speech and more on the printed word. This was all to the good, according to Malesherbes and his colleagues. Whereas sound was fleeting, a printed word was not. One could go over a text and review its contents. Whereas speech appealed to the passions, the written word called forth reflection and careful thought. This was neither the first nor the last time that the capacity of the printed word to provoke emotional response or to incite readers to take violent action was underestimated. The belief that a free press would usher in a new era of rational politics and put an end to the dangerous enthusiasms kindled by rabble-rousing preachers and orators received its strongest support during the French Revolution. By then, the praise of printing had already acquired a political cutting edge. Observers of Anglo-American affairs had seen how the press could be deployed against kings as well as priests. The great tribunal of mankind has been found. It is the press, declared Jacques-Pierre Brissot, who'd been to America, visited Washington and Mount Vernon, and made friends with Tom Paine before winning celebrity as the editor of the Patriote Française. During his American journey, Brissot was especially impressed by the remarkable success of Tom Paine's Common Sense. He was persuaded that Paine's work would have remained without much effect if it had been left in its original pamphlet form. The idea that its success was due to its being repeatedly reprinted in newspapers underlies Brissot's oft-cited remark, without newspapers, the American Revolution would never have succeeded. Brissot's memoir to the Estates General of 1789 reiterated his views on the transformative powers of the newspaper press. Only by its means could a large and populous modern country recreate the public forums of the classic city-states. Only through the press could one teach the same truth at the same moment to millions of men, and only through the press could men discuss it without tumult and decide calmly and give their opinion. I must say, when I read those words again, I kept thinking about passage of a recent bill, without tumult, calmly. The same views were shared by members of a revolutionary society called the Cercle Social. Its most famous member was Marquis de Condorcet, sometimes described as the last of the philosophes. Like D'Alembert, Condorcet was a gifted mathematician who marveled at the advances that had been made in the sciences after the advent of printing. He was, however, more gifted as a mathematician than as a politician. As was true of so many others, he lacked oratorical skill and associated eloquence with demagoguery. In his view, print spelled the end of a political system based on secrecy and on arbitrary power, the end of prejudice, superstition, and indeed of all organized religion. He collaborated with Tom Paine on a journal called Le Républicain, which advocated the abolition of the monarchy after the fight to Varennes in 1791. In his sketch of the progress of the human race, he wrote, it was fortunate that some of Gutenberg's contemporaries had recognized the capacity of printing to unmask priests and dethrone kings, or they would have strangled the new art in its infancy. Other members of the Cercle also elaborated on the mythology which developed around the invention of printing and the figure of the publisher. Gutenberg's discovery was described as the most important event in the history of mankind. It would doom all political systems that were based on secrecy and arbitrary power. One deputy who served with Condorcet on the Committee of Public Instruction prophesied that the age of the priest was being replaced by the age of the publisher. It was necessary to have religions before the invention, he claimed, but printing, the most beautiful gift from heaven, had freed man from bondage to conflicting confessional creeds. The old regime was the age of the priest, the new would be the age of the publisher. I hope Jerry is listening. The glorification of the inventor went together with that of the invention. Tributes to Gutenberg reached a climax in an address to the newly formed National Convention on September 2, 1792. In the name of all printers, the address requested that the remains of the inventor be placed in the Pantheon. A paraphrased excerpt runs as follows. If God invented the sun, man invented the printing press. The divinely created sun dissipates physical darkness. The man-made sun vanquishes spiritual darkness. Let us celebrate an inventor who was the first true revolutionary, without whom we would be mute and isolated on earth, without whom we would have never known either a Voltaire or a Rousseau or a Pantheon. Voltaire and Rousseau were, at that point, had been put in the Pantheon. This passionate plea for placing Gutenberg's remains in the Pantheon was delivered by a deputy to the National Convention who was a true cosmopolite. A German-Dutch baron named Jean-Baptiste Clootz, who found his first names too Christian and substituted the more pagan Anacharsis. Clootz's petition was received with enthusiasm at first, but Enlightenment cosmopolitanism soon gave way to a new bellicose nationalism. In October 1793, little more than a year after he delivered his request to honor Gutenberg, Clootz himself was denounced as a foreign agitator and expelled from the convention. In March 1794, he was accused of being implicated in a foreign plot and was guillotined. By then, 1794, the idea of placing a German culture hero in a French national shrine had become unthinkable. During the decades that ensued, Napoleon gained control of the territories that had sustained the cosmopolitan Francophone press. When he redrew the map of Europe, he obliterated many of the small states and principalities that had sustained heterodox publication. He reinstituted preliminary and preventative censorship, and by the time he signed his concordat with the Pope, it became evident that the future belonged neither to the church nor to the publisher. The century of the nation state was on hand, and the time allotted to this lecture has come to an end.
So much. We have time for a few questions. Could I just ask you, as Betty noted at the outset, that she was hard of hearing, so if you stand and pose your question loudly, then we'll try and answer it. Questions?
Okay.
Yes, John?
Hi,
John, behind the slides.
I was interested how this evening your focus was much more on the revolutionary possibilities of print as they were part of 18th century discourse. Last night we heard a little bit about how the church, the Catholic Church, was very receptive to print in the early years. So I was sort of curious what you know about the 18th century church's feeling about print.
Peter raised this question partly during the seminar we had.
I wasn't there.
That's all right. Most of the people who attended, I don't think, are here for the lecture. Not many were Peter's. But there's no question it's very complicated because, as I pointed out, there were, in France, there was a split between the Jansenists and the Jesuits. The Jansenists had their own clandestine Nouvelle Ecclesiastique They used print for all it was worth in trying to combat the powers that be. And they translated the Bible much against the will of the Catholics. So it's very complicated in France. It's very complicated in England, where you have a represent communities using foreign pressures to try to bring material into England. It's a very complex picture, much more complex than maybe suggested by this particular lecture. I do try to bring that out elsewhere. But there is still, I think, one fundamental key, which is something I hadn't anticipated when I started on this, which is that the Protestants wove print into a fundamental narrative, which was an emancipatory narrative, directed first against the Pope, and then, as radicals developed and so forth, against priests in England, against bishops and kings in the Civil War, and in France, against priests during the de-Christianizing movement. It had a momentum, this rebellious aspect, because of this emancipatory narrative, whereas the Catholics never developed anything quite the same, although it did mean that the revolutionaries broke completely with the church. I don't think that helps at all. Yes, could you?
I was struck by the fact that he chose John Wilkes and the North Briton.
About John Wilkes?
Yes. I was struck by the fact that you chose him quite late in your period to talk about the centrality of print to political processes. Whereas I would have thought this argument can be worked backwards all the way to a figure like Daniel Defoe, who was very certain that print had a very ambivalent role to play, or indeed any number of 17th century
Why did I select John Wilkes?
And why so late?
All these other authors who much earlier. As a matter of fact, in my book, I talk about Defoe a little, because he has some wonderful things to say about Gutenberg's partner, Fust, and Faustus, the Faustus legend, and his history of the devil. And so he was, the reason I selected John Wilkes is because of his political impression. He was a member of Parliament. And he had tremendous political effect, whereas Defoe, who did write as a, shall I say, hired hand for various different political patrons, didn't have his independent political. Wilkes became elected, was elected Lord Mayor of London when the Parliament was already objecting to him. I mean, it's an extraordinary story. He defied, but he did it with the help of large numbers of printers and publishers in London who all supported him. It's really, I think, the first political case where the use of print actually forced open the doors of Parliament. That's why I talk about it. I think it's, I mean, it also the resonance of the Wilkes experience is remarkable. There were handkerchiefs out of Wilkes being worn in Paris. There were, in America, there was, well, you can read about it in Vernon Galen, I think, has a lot on John Wilkes and his effect. But anyway.
I'm just wondering, because you could make a similar case without the sort of specificity and power of the Wilkes case for much of what was happening about parliamentary debates.
I'm sorry, I didn't understand.
But all I'm saying is that you could make a similar case about the way print was mobilized in order to make a change in parliamentary processes as early as the English Civil Wars.
Oh, that I did talk about. But then what happened? I mean, I said it was turned against bishops.
Yes.
As well, and kings. I mean, I was thinking of Charles the First. But, as you know, that didn't last for very long.
Oh, that's right.
I mean, there was the Restoration.
Other questions? This question
yes.
Over here.
I just have a question about the difference between printers and publishers. And in the 18th century, as the rise of the publishing house, like how that works out in impressions about printing.
Oh, well, it starts being complicated even in the 16th century, I think, because the term printer can cover the publisher, and sometimes the two are completely separate. And then one publisher has about 7 printers that he farms out work to, and it's very confusing because the terms used are not specific. It's a little like a scriptor, which sometimes can actually mean not just scribe, but printer. I mean, the terminology is not specific in a way that we would be able to.
It seems.
But there are functions performed by different people, and you can distinguish them. And I think that it depends where you're looking in the 18th century. But let's say, I hesitate to generalize even there, but the bookseller fulfills the role largely of the publisher, bookseller. But there are some printers who are booksellers and not publishers.
And it's just easy to deify the technology. You have the printing press in the clouds, but you don't have a bookseller in the clouds. You know, like the technology.
The spirit of printing, you mean holding.
Right, the print technology can be deified, but the guy who's coordinating all the publication of a book, it's maybe harder to deify that person.
Yes. Yeah. Well, there, I think, is where they developed this nostalgia for the 16th century, and so have this picture that. And right after the age of Gutenberg, I mean, these great figures of all this, read Erasmus on all of this. I mean, I cited some of the praises are unbelievable. The same is true with the Etienne, and the same is true with a great many others. The people, was it Danish Gospel? I can't think of the name of all the prayers. Froben. We go on and on. Even now in our books, I think. There's a tendency to glamorize and glorify these Renaissance prayers and not appreciate the extent to which commerce was on their minds. Though I myself, having looked at some of their output, can glamorize them myself. Their works are so magnificent. There isn't a falling out, I think, by the impact. I'm very torn about this, whether I'm falling into the golden age of mythology myself.
All right, I think we have time for like one more question, so.
Oh dear, that makes it hard.
Okay. Does anyone have a, there we do, what question back?
I just wanted to say, I found it very interesting to listen yesterday and today to your narrative of sort of a shift in, or gradually developing shift in the perspective, the perspectives on print. But I'm just curious, for example, in this sort of emergent 18th century discourse around the political efficacy of print, how well does the emergence of this discourse correspond to the actuality of the function of print in practice?
Are you thinking about the political aspect here? Or?
Well, I'm just wondering, as the perspective on print changes, does this correspond to
What's
an actual...
What's interesting, of course, is you're still in the age. Next lecture will be in a new age, the steam press. So I'll try to point out that this isn't all that new, because attitudes haven't changed much. But you're in the age of the hand press throughout this period. So in terms of technology, you're pretty much in the same. I mean, of course, a lot has happened between the 16th and the 18th century in terms of waterways and postal services and improvements. I said 18th century improvements, which make distribution of papers and books and things much facilitates it greatly. But I'm not sure if you feel.
Well, I'm just curious, as 18th century French writers start to write about the political power, or not only French, start to write about the political power of print, are they discovering something that was already there, or are they actually mapping a change in the way?
I think they're mapping a change as far as these speeches to the French Academy and so forth about publicly, more Roger probably knows more about this than I do, but the speeches about what interests me is this media analysis. It comes out very forcefully where eloquence is rejected and oratory is rejected as being too emotional.
and two women. I'm always amazed to hear I am already a senator. It's all oral, even now. But nevertheless, there was this very peculiar, it seems to me, analysis, which I found over and over, that, and Benjamin Franklin has it too, about oratories. Here comes the orator with his dog reason and his load of words or something. And there was this sort of rebellion against rhetoric and eloquence, which have been upheld so much during the Renaissance, and this sense that for some reason, reading just, well, it's a matter of presence and distance and whatever. And there was the sense that a printed word gave you a chance to take it over, distance yourself. You're not swayed by the presence of the orator, the demagogue, or the priest. And therefore, citizens would decide quietly in the presence of their printed materials and think it over and decide whether something would work or not. Of course, the idea of a printed constitution goes a little bit with this, which is you don't decide things prima facie. You don't decide according to, this is very much hey, it's against birth. You decide these things by means of a printed organ, which tells you pretty much how to balance everything. That's arrived at sort of map by terms of mathematical reason rather than on the spur of the moment article. It fascinates me because there's a lot of media analysis in the difference between orality and literacy in this debate about demagogues versus seen reasonable politicians. But I don't understand it because nobody is more of a demagogue than Marat in this newspaper. But I'm saying exactly what John Adams said, by the way. He has a wonderful, I have it in my book, John Adams' Commentary on Conversation. It's absolutely remarkable. He disagrees with everything Conversation says.
Shall we? Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you for coming, and we will see you Thursday evening at 5:30 for the final lecture in this year's Rosenbach Lectures. Thank you.